all for this evening's BBC Prom. They're waiting for us, Petroc Trelawney.
Hello, tonight at the Prom's a wonderful Sunday night programme that embraces two great German operas, a glittering masterpiece of 20th century French orchestral writing, and a violin concerto that served as a requiem for an 18-year-old girl. Frank-Peter Zimmermann will be the soloist in Alban Berg's violin concerto, written in honour of Manon Gropius, daughter of Mahler's widow. Berg, a true man of Vienna, and it's the greatest of all Viennese dances, seen against the decline of the Austro-Hungarian Empire that inspired Ravel in La Valse. And Vienna is where the suite from Strauss's opera Der Rosenkavalier had its premiere. Well, on the rostrum tonight, Daniele Gatti, who has conducted Wagner's Parsifal for the past 3 years in the opera house at Bayreuth, the composer's spiritual home. To open this evening's concert by the Gustav Mahler Youth Orchestra, he's chosen the sublime Good Friday music from the opera. Unusually, he's preceding it with the solemn Anguish Prelude to Act 3, rarely heard as a concert extract.
I think this connection is working. It's also, dramatically, I think it could be also interesting because the prelude is starting with this sort of deep darkness, pain of the soul of Parsifal. And then the connection is the moment when Gurnemanz is blessing the wounded knight. So it works like a little bit the bridge passing from the sufferance, and because the sufferance, a man is probably able to find a redemption.
Daniele Gatti talking to me earlier on today, the Gustav Mahler Youth Orchestra rehearsing here at the Royal Albert Hall this morning. They're on stage now, players aged between 18 and 26, drawn from across Europe. Bolzano is where they rehearse and where they started this tour, which has subsequently taken them on to the Edinburgh Festival and now to the Proms before they go on to the Concertgebouw in Amsterdam. Well, during the journey depicted in the prelude to Act 3, Parsifal is, we're told, confronted with numberless dangers, battles and conflicts. Yet there's a deeper existential anguish as well, as his eyes are opened to the sorrows of the world. Then Parsifal returns to the domains of the Grail with the sacred healing spear. His feet are bathed and he declares that on Good Friday, every living thing should only sigh and sorrow. The Good Friday music reaching the very heart of Wagner's opera. Daniele Gatti takes his position on stage to open tonight's Prom with the Gustav Mahler Youth Orchestra. The Good Friday music, and before it, the prelude to Act 3 of Wagner's opera Parsifal. Daniele Gatti conducting the Gustav Mahler Youth Orchestra here at the BBC Proms. Vast orchestra on stage in front of us tonight. 40 violins leading the string section. As well as conducting Wagner at Bayreuth, Gatti music director of the Orchestre National de France since September 2008 and chief conductor of the Zurich Opera House for the past 3 years. Now, music from the 1930s next tonight. April 1935 saw the death from polio of Manon Gropius, Mützi as she was known, daughter of Mahler's widow Alma and the architect Walter Gropius. Deeply shocked at the news, Alban Begg dedicated his violin concerto to her, writing on the score, "To the memory of a young angel." In fact, the work was to become the composer's own requiem. He died just 4 months after he completed the score. Tonight, the concerto is played by the German violinist Frank-Peter Zimmermann.
Of course, he was very shocked by Manon Gropius' death. But on the other hand, I think he was just so unhappy and fearful because, as you know, he wrote the piece in 35 and 33. His works were not allowed to be played in Germany anymore. He had big financial problems. He had just, well, he was afraid of the future. And probably he was also feeling his own end coming. Definitely, I think you can feel it in the piece too. And then, of course, all these other stories around. I mean, let's say the Corinthian song, which, you know, they just found out some couple of years ago that he had a, how do you say it, illegal child when he was 16 in Carinthia with a girl. And he came back to this Corinthian song. I mean, or also always mentioning the two notes Ha in German, which is B in English, and F, which means the first letters of Hanna Fuchs, his lover in Prague. But what a great piece. And I think overall it's not just a regular violin concerto, like, let's say, the second Bartok is, where the piece stinks like a violin. But the Berg on top is a piece of art. It is a real, well, it has got everything, a universe.
Frank-Peter Zimmermann, well, that Corinthian folk tune that shows something of the grace and charm of Manon Gropius features in the second movement of part one of the concerto. In the closing section into part two, we hear one of Bach's church cantatas, played in Bach's own harmonization, the words associated with the chorale, "It is enough, Lord, when it pleases thee, bring my life to an end." The work begins in a gentle, dreamy mood, perhaps also reflecting Manon's character, then the beginning of the second movement, rather more violent, pervaded with a feeling of horror and anguish, perhaps Berg expressing his frustration at the death of a friend at such a tender age. So here comes Frank-Peter Zimmermann with Daniele Gatti to join the Gustav Mahler Youth Orchestra in Alban Berg's Violin Concerto.
Thank you.
Frank Peter Zimmermann played Alban Berg's violin concerto, the Gustav Mahler Youth Orchestra, conducted by Daniele Gatti. Zimmermann told me earlier this is a work that's absolutely central to his career. He reckons he's played it over 100 times since he first performed it as a 22-year-old, quarter of a century ago. It is, he says, a work that he simply never tires of. When a new edition was published a couple of years back, he was asked to contribute fingerings to the publication. He returns to the platform with Daniele Gatti. Hands high in the air as Zimmermann claps the orchestra and takes a bow just alongside the conductor's rostrum. Now Gatti brings the players of the Mahler Youth Orchestra to their feet. The violin concerto written when Berg was busy with Lulu. Possible that he would never have written it, was he not in need of money when the American violinist Louis Krasner made the commission. He wasn't terribly interested in writing a violin concerto. Then found inspiration with the death of his friend Manon Gropius. Finishing the piece, Berg intended to have a period of rest, but he was stung by a bee, led to a carbuncle and a series of boils which caused him extreme pain. An internal abscess then burst, leading to blood poisoning. He died on Christmas Eve 1935, just 4 months after the violin concerto had been finished. Now looks like we're going to have an encore. Thank you. The Andante from Bach's A minor violin sonata. What a perfect choice of encore by Frank Petersen, perfectly tying in with the Bach chorale quoted at the end of the second movement of the Berg violin concerto. It is enough, Lord, when it pleases thee, bring my life to an end. Zimmermann returns, clutching his violin, a 1711 Stradivarius that once belonged to Fritz Kreisler. Bach, Mozart, Beethoven, but also Kurt Weill, Ligeti and Matthias Pinscher amongst the violin concertos that are central to his career. Well, Radio 3 live at the Proms this Sunday night, and we're going to stay here in the hall during the interval. We've Rosenkavalier coming up, Suite from Rosenkavalier, and La Valse by Ravel. That'll be in 20 minutes' time. Meantime, I'm going to be joined by the actor John Sessions, who's in the audience here at the Royal Albert Hall tonight. We'll have a natter shortly. We'll have another of our postcards sent in advance by visiting orchestras. This evening, players from the Leipzig Gewandhaus Orchestra, who are here next weekend. And to begin, more on the often fascinating history of the area around the Royal Albert Hall, and our weekly date with Dr. Lucy Worsley, Chief Curator at the historic Royal Palaces. This evening, she's just over the road with a fascinating character from the 18th century.
I'm at the Royal College of Music, and I'm standing in its musical museum with its curator, Jenny Nex, and we are looking at a portrait, a rather fat, rather florid-faced young man in a blue coat, and he is actually Farinelli, the stage name of the most successful and famous opera singer of the 18th century.
Yes, there's a fabulous portrait by Nazzari of this wonderful singer. Portraits are very useful things to us who are interested in historical performance, because they can often tell us things that we don't know about from other sources, or they can reinforce things that we do know about. So we very much think of him as a singer, but there are other things going on in this portrait other than that. He's got one hand resting on a keyboard instrument, and we know from an inventory made when he died that he had a large collection of keyboard instruments, so this may well be one from his own collection. Then on top of the instrument, you can see there's some manuscript paper, there's an inkwell with a quill pen, and that, of course, is telling us that he also composed, and indeed there are a number of his songs that survive. They have early editions of them here in London in the British Library. There's also a rather nice dog in the bottom corner there. He's one of my favourite things in here. We're not quite sure why there's a dog there. He's quite often depicted with a dog. It may be simply that he liked dogs, but dogs do appear in works of art as symbols of fidelity. And, of course, musicians at this date would tend to be employees at best, servants at worst. So they wanted to be depicted as being faithful to their masters. So it may be a symbol of that. There are some other things that we're even less sure about. He's wearing one white glove.
Yes, why is that?
We really don't know, and I would love to have a convincing answer about this. There's also one pearl earring in his left ear, so there's definitely something going on the left-hand side. And, of course, in the theatre, where singers such as Farinelli would have spent a lot of their time, the distinction between left and right is very significant, with all the bad things, the sinister, coming from the left side. So whether he's kind of counteracting that with his white glove and his pearl earring, that's one suggestion. But really, we're not 100% sure about that. So if anybody out there in the big world can give us a good answer, I'm at the end of an email.
Is he a little bit fat and florid because he has been castrated?
There's a great deal of discussion and research, I understand, going on at the moment about the physique of the castrated male. Another interesting thing about the portrait is that he's got depicted with a little bit of facial hair. And the question is, did he really have facial hair, or is that artistic license, or did he wear makeup? There's also the question of the length of limbs, because apparently the castrated male body grows longer limbs. It doesn't know when to stop growing. So
Do you think his arms are extra extra long.
Well, that's a
question. Am I imagining that now?
It may be that, yes. I mean, there has been a big research project about him recently, and they actually got permission to dig him up. And it was a bit of a problem, because he was originally buried in a cemetery just outside Bologna, and that cemetery was destroyed a long time ago, I think early 19th century. But they managed to find some records that showed that his remains were actually moved to another cemetery. So they then did research on that, and then they discovered that he'd then been dug up again because his grandniece, I think she was, who kind of managed his reputation after his death, if you like, she'd asked that he would be buried with her. So they then located her grave and got permission to exhume that, which they then did, and they found, I think, a perfectly preserved female skeleton with a few bones at her feet, which is rather sad, really. But I think they have actually done a little bit of research that's been published quite recently on what their findings are with relation to these long limbs and the way the male body doesn't do what one would expect it to had it been left to grow naturally.
This is an account of Farinelli actually singing. The first note he sung was taken with such delicacy, swelled by minute degrees to such an amazing volume, and afterwards diminished in the same manner to a mere point, that it was applauded for full 5 minutes. He was paid £1,500 for a season in Handel's company, but presents and gifts from his admirers actually increased this to £5,000. And it was all a bit unsustainable. He sort of crashed and burned. He was massively, massively popular. And he ended up as private musician to the Spanish royal family and never sang again in public.
Dr. Lucy Worsley at the Royal College of Music, and you can see that portrait of Farinelli for yourself, along with all sorts of fascinating historical musical instruments and documents at the gallery of the college, which is open to the public Tuesday to Friday, 11:30 through until 4:30, or you can go at other times by appointment. Tuesday to Friday, 11:30 to 4:30, Royal College of Music, just across the road from us here at the Royal Albert Hall. And next week, in what will be her last report, Lucy will be visiting the home of an eccentric Victorian photographer. Just the sort of character my guest here at the Proms, John Sessions, might have played or might yet play in his career.
Oh, I'm working on it, yes.
Actor, comedian, improviser, mimic, stranger to Radio 3, clutching a chilled glass of white wine. I'm horrified to say in a plastic cup. I'd have thought we could have run to a glass.
I'm just keeping it for somebody else.
But there we are. Yes. A response to the first half of the programme?
Absolutely wonderful. I mean, the Wagner was absolutely astonishing. I love Parsifal. You know, I mean, such a loathsome man. He did write wonderful music. But the piece that really did it for me was the Berg. That was just sensational. The violin concerto. And I love it. Absolutely loved it. And then that little partita he played.
It was the Andante from a sonata by Bach. Yes,
I thought it was Bach.
A minor violin sonata, which tied in perfectly with the Bach that's quoted in the Berg.
Yeah.
I suppose that Berg violin concerto, probably the most heard bit of music from the second Viennese school.
It's probably the most popular, isn't it? I mean, I was just saying there to one of your colleagues that I've only recently, in the last 2 or 3 years, really, 5 years maybe, come to the Viennese school, you know, the second Viennese school. I used to think it was all just a silly noise, but then I realised that we leave that to Pierre Boulez. But, the Viennese
That'll
school...
That'll have got people going.
Yeah, yeah. But the... I love the way they put him in nearly every programme. It makes me laugh so
well,
much.
Well, he sat very well in the Beethoven with the West Eastern Divan Orchestra.
Did he?
You know, amazing to hear and see 6,000 people here and, you know, tens of thousands of people watching Boulez's music on radio and TV. But if you're not a fan, we won't go there.
Pierre, God bless you and love you. I hope you live to be a ripe old age, even older than you are now.
But say more about your discovery
of... You're not Karlheinz Stockhausen, anyway.
Say more about your discovery of the Second Viennese School.
That came when I was doing a show. I wrote a little show for Michael Barclay and Radio 3 where I pretended to be a 112-year-old cellist called Manfred Stürmer, who had dealings with the Viennese school. And in the course of researching it, obviously, I had to listen to quite a lot of Berg and Schoenberg and Webern, and I thought, oh, gosh, I've really been, what have I been missing all these years, you know? I think the Berg Violin Concerto, Schoenberg Verklärtenacht, and Gurrelieder, but that's still quite Mahlerian, really, isn't it?
Mm.
It's before he goes serial.
Wonderful Gurrelieder here at the Proms, what, 2 weeks ago?
Oh,
tonight?
I wish I sadly didn't hear it. Can I just very quickly say hello to my dear friend Adrian Phillips in South Wales? We've been friends for 40 years, and he's a huge fan of the Proms. So God bless you, Adrian. Hope you're listening.
Is he a Proms fan on the radio, or does he ever get
Proms fan of the radio, but he and his wife Angela also come up here and visit and enjoy the music.
Someone tells me you have this, I think you call it a sickness, where your memory enables you to remember very specific things, including the birth dates of composers.
Yes, yes. Even Oldenburg, 1885, 1935.
Ravel?
Ravel, 18...
You can hear in the second half.
1875, 1937.
Brilliant. We'll continue that. Strauss?
Richard, 1864, 1949.
Yep, very good. Wagner?
1813, February 1883 in Venice. I remember that.
Date in February?
Second?
Unlucky for some.
Not second.
13th.
Yeah,
that's very good.
Mixed it up with Joyce's birthday. He was February the 2nd.
That's 10 out of 10. You did a film where you had to play the violin.
I did. I had the great honour of working for Mr. Robert De Niro a few years ago. Friend, I was just telling somebody the story. After I had done the film, I was here presenting an Eye to the Proms for BBC Two, and Gil Shahan played quite brilliantly the Stravinsky Violin Concerto, and I had to interview him up in the box, and he offered me his Stradivarius to play the 2.5 minutes of Tchaikovsky, which I had learnt, I had been taught sedulously by the glorious and beautiful Cleo Gould and her delightful brother Tom, and then they passed the baton on to a lady at the New York Philharmonic. When I went over to do the film in New York, I rehearsed it every day with a lady called Sandy Park. And I eventually got to the point. The really tricky thing, Petrok, is vibrato. And we can all more or less do the index finger, but when it's the fourth finger, it gets quite tricky.
And when it was close up, it was really your hand? Because, I mean, sometimes they make films about pianists and they have a real pianist's hands
It was me. It was me. I mean, the noise I made was so horrid. It doesn't even bear talking about. But the finger work was right. And I had to learn a piece of, as well as the Tchaikovsky, I had to learn a piece of Massenet, which very sadly got cut from the film. But seeing as the original cut of the film was 5 hours 40 minutes, I was very lucky to be in it at all, to be absolutely honest.
I'm sure there's some sort of party piece you could do there with a sort of ghetto blaster with the music on, and you could sort of play
to
it. You're currently playing a violin loving detective.
Yes, indeed. I've just completed playing actually Sir Arthur Conan Doyle in a television series called Mr. Selfridge, which I think you might fairly describe as Downton Abbey with shopping. It's the history of Selfridges.
Gordon Selfridge, wasn't it?
The chap's called Harry in our story.
Right.
And he's played by a delightful American actor called Jeremy Pavin, who has some success in America with a series called Entourage. Very nice chap. And so doing that. And then I'm going back to complete filming a film I started filming earlier this year called Filth, which is based on the Irvin Welsh novel about a very, very corrupt policeman played by James McAvoy. It's my second film with James.
And your role?
Very nice man he is. I play James's boss, a man called Bob Toll, who's a complete idiot. And Jamie Bell plays James's sidekick. And Jim Broadbent plays his doctor. And Eddie Marzan plays his very silly friend from the civil service, and I think that's about everybody.
Well, it sounds like a pretty impressive cast.
Well, it is a nice, and it's a great piece, and we hope the public like it.
Are we going to hear you doing any more Private Passions after your success in various roles?
Well, thank you, Petrok. I have a little plan, a little plot to do Verdi talking about Wagner and vice versa next year, because it's the bicentennial
indeed
of both of them.
Yes.
And there was no love lost between Wagner and Verdi, as you could imagine. And I just thought it might be amusing.
You're not going to give us your Britain next year?
Oh, crikey. I'd forgotten. Oh, well, maybe I'll have to work him in. Yes.
To choose a piece of music that, were you to schedule your fantasy prom, you would put in prime position. What is it?
Pulcinella by Stravinsky. Oh, I absolutely love it. For me, it just wonderfully evokes a sort of hot, blue-skied Mediterranean, statues, beautiful young people. Just wonderful. And it's his neoclassical period. I think, rather like as with Picasso, who at the same time went into a sort of neoclassicism, it's Stravinsky at his most intriguing, really.
We'll have a little extract to whet the appetite. John Sessions, always lovely to see you. Thank you for joining us.
Lovely, Petrok. Thank you very much.
Part of the Pulcinella Suite by Stravinsky, as chosen by my guest and fellow prommer John Sessions, Israel Philharmonic Orchestra with Leonard Bernstein. Well, we're 5 minutes or so away from the first notes of part two of this Sunday night prom, as the Gustav Mahler Youth Orchestra perform Richard Strauss. Next weekend, another European ensemble visits the world's oldest civic orchestra, the Leipzig Gewandhaus Orchestra. Two of its players send a postcard from the city that they call home.
My name's Tom Greenleaves, and I'm from Swanage in Dorset, and I'm timpanist of the Leipzig Gewandhaus Orchestra, and I've been in the orchestra for 6 years.
My name is Yoon-jin Cho. I come from Korea. I'm first violinist in Gewandhaus Orchestra, and I play in the orchestra since 4 years.
The first of our two proms, which is next Saturday evening, is a purely Mendelssohn program. Mendelssohn was Gewandhaus Kapellmeister in the middle of the 19th century. He spent many years in Leipzig in charge of the orchestra. An enormous part of his output was premiered here by the orchestra. We certainly see that That's very much home territory and something that we're very proud of, our Mendelssohn tradition. When we go on foreign tours, it's very normal that we have Mendelssohn. That's what we take out from Leipzig into the world.
It's definitely the traditional historical orchestra in Germany, or like worldwide. But when I started here, I was actually quite surprised because it was very international and there were very many young musicians. And that makes me very happy to come to work and just to enjoy and make friends. When I played in proms with the Gewandhaus Orchestra, it was 3 years ago, that was a really special moment for me because, first of all, the hall was just huge and I was very shocked. People were very relaxed. It was like a pop concert.
It's incredible in the Royal Albert Hall because it's one of the few halls in the world where it doesn't actually matter that the acoustic isn't really ideal. But that doesn't matter to any musician who plays at the proms because it's an absolutely unique atmosphere. The most wonderful thing about the proms is the audience. It's really the most enthusiastic, the most awake, the most welcoming audience anywhere in the world without question.
Players from the Leipzig Gewandhaus Orchestra, and in addition to next Saturday's All Mendelssohn Prom, the Leipzig Gewandhaus Orchestra will be playing a concert of Mahler and music by Olivier Messiaen next Sunday at 7:30. bbc.co.uk/proms for details. Well, we're live at the Proms this Sunday, where members of the Gustav Mahler Youth Orchestra are returning to the platform to continue what is the orchestra's Silver Jubilee 2012 season, a tour which started in Bolzano, where the orchestra rehearses, then went on to Salzburg, Lucerne and the Edinburgh Festival, the Amsterdam Concertgebouw and the Stresa Festival still to come. Well, I've been talking with the orchestra's conductor on this summer tour, Daniele Gatti, and we began by discussing the obvious passion of this elite young orchestra.
I'm deeply convinced that he's a young professional orchestra. It's not just a youth orchestra of students. No, the average of it's more or less 25. No? And they're absolutely outstanding musicians. And you can find those musicians also in the professional orchestra today. In Europe, above all, there's a changement of a generation of musicians. So a lot of the main orchestra are composed by young musicians, and a lot of them are coming from the Mahler Jugendorchester. So I treated them absolutely at the most professional way. And the results that I obtained from them is it's really outstanding. I'm very, very happy to be here in London with them, with this special program, which they play the first half in very deep way with this kind of meaning of expression and also redemption, because the Baroque Concerto, which we already heard, is a sort of a trip from the heart to the hymen.
And something deeply touching about hearing young people performing this concerto dedicated to a dead 18-year-old.
They're very humble in front of such great monument of music. The experience, I think, of the young musician in front of great composition is that they can meet for the first time, to play for the first time, and to have the occasion to play it for the live and to grow up with them more than probably pieces that are excellent, fantastic, but a bit more virtuoso with other meaning in the music.
There's something, it strikes me, of sort of underlying sense of melancholy running through the programme this evening. If you think about the Marschallin and Rosenkavalier, obviously the Berg, La Valse, this
yes,
kind of portrait
of a declining
Vienna.
In a way, yes. There's a bit of nostalgia also in the second half. But it's combined with a sort of virtuosism in the orchestra way to rhythm. Take La Valse. The orchestra is interested also to discover this kind of repertoire. But I think with the reading, which privilege all the time the musical side of that, not the virtuoso side.
Daniele Gatti talking to me after this morning's rehearsal. Well, La Valse in about 20 minutes after we hear the suite from Richard Strauss's opera Der Rosenkavalier. Begins with the unashamed depiction of lovemaking between the 32-year-old Marschallin and the 17-year-old Count Octavian. That's in Act 1. Then the scene where Octavian presents the silver rose to Sophie. Baron Ox's Act 2 waltz Ohne Mich follows, reprised when Mariandel, the servant girl, Octavian in disguise, invites Ox to join her for high jinks at the inn. Later we hear the famous trio, still ravishing even without voices, followed by the Act Three love duet between Octavian and Zofie, and then a reprise of Baron Ox's waltz to finish. Daniele Gatti conducts the Gustav Mahler Youth Orchestra in the suite from Richard Strauss's opera, Der Rosenkavalier. We'll be right back. The Gustav Mahler Youth Orchestra playing the suite from Richard Strauss's opera Der Rosenkavalier. Daniele Gatti conducting here at the Proms to a capacity Royal Albert Hall audience this Sunday night. Far from clear whether Strauss had any actual role in this suite, which was put together in 1945, or even, as Michael Kennedy writes in tonight's programme, whether he would have approved of its reordering of events. No one seems quite sure who did create it. The conductor, Arta Rodzinski, the favoured candidate. He it is who the suite is attributed to in tonight's programme. Gatti returns to the stage. He's never actually conducted Rosenkavalier, despite a very distinguished career in opera. Asked him if he might consider doing it at some point, and he said that thought he'd rather now move too far down the Wagner route for that to be a serious possibility. It's 1911 that the Rosenkavalier waltzes arrived here at the Proms. Before the actual opera itself had had its UK premiere. And while purists may object to the idea of ripping waltzes out of a complete opera, like Wagner, Richard Strauss was very relaxed about the idea, appreciating the commercial value of what he'd written and happily conducting and arranging them for concert use. Well, Radio 3, the home of the BBC Proms, live at the Royal Albert Hall this Sunday night. Just 2 weeks left of the 2012 season, alas, but still plenty of treats before the last night. The John Wilson Orchestra rehearsing this afternoon for their Broadway Sound concert tomorrow. That's at 8 o'clock. Judging by the rehearsal, it's going to be pretty amazing. Marriage of Figaro from Glyndebourne on Tuesday night. Berlin Philharmonic and Simon Rattle on Thursday and Friday. And next weekend, two recitals by the charismatic and colourful American organist Cameron Carpenter. That's 4 o'clock next Saturday and Sunday afternoons. Full details at bbc.co.uk/proms. Well, to finish tonight's concert, Ravel's choreographic poem La Valse. Choreographic poem because it was commissioned by Diaghilev for his ballet Russe, and then in what must have been rather a sticky situation, rejected by the mercurial impresario. Poulenc was present when Ravel played the piece through to Diaghilev and recalled seeing, first of all, Diaghilev's monocle and then his false teeth twitch. Didn't like the piece one bit, and at the end of the session turned to the composer and told him so. Ravel, he said, it's a masterpiece, but it isn't a ballet. It's a portrait of a ballet, a painting of a ballet. Relations between the two men never really recovered. But of course, Diaghilev was right. When the piece had been conceived in 1906, it was to be a work paying homage to the Viennese waltz, those of Strauss Jr. in particular. By the time he wrote it in 1919 and 1920, the war had changed the image of Vienna forever, and the Austro-Hungarian Empire itself had been dissolved. Here was a look back to life at the imperial court in the 1850s, seen as what Ravel described as a fantastic and fateful whirlpool. Sense of decline and decay never far from the surface. Daniele Gatti returns for the final time this evening to conduct the Gustav Mahler Youth Orchestra in Ravel's La Valse. Thank you. Daniele Gatti kisses the hand of Diana Tyshchenko, leader of the Gustav Mahler Youth Orchestra, after that performance of Ravel's La Valse. here at the Proms. As Ravel described it, a kind of apotheosis of the waltz, impressionist and expressionist, side by side in the same frame. Dancers in motion, spotted through occasional breaks in whirling clouds, and the glow of the chandeliers breaks out fortissimo, an imperial court about 1855. That Ravel's own scenario for the piece that he wrote, commissioned by Serge Diaghilev, and appreciated the quality of Daphnis and Chloe, which Ravel had composed for him in 1912. And perhaps he never quite believed Ravel could make it as a ballet composer, but surely thought the idea of the waltz would make a brilliant ballet score. Well, ballet's lost, the concert hall's gained, spectacularly so. Getty returned then to take another bow, but stood well back, allowing the musicians of the Gustav Mahler Youth Orchestra to take the spotlight. Players aged up to 26. The orchestra founded by Claudio Abbado back in 1986 in Vienna, the first international youth orchestra to hold open auditions in the countries of the former Eastern Bloc. Today regarded as one of the world's finest youth orchestras. Auditions take place every year in over 25 European cities. 2,500 applicants whittled down to the well over 100 who make it to the orchestra. The sections now being brought up one by one to their feet. Woodwind now. Percussion section, brass already standing. And the massive string section. The bass is to the left of the stage as Getty stands facing the orchestra. Strings, violins split either side, first and seconds. He claps the orchestra, leaves the stage again. We shouldn't forget that we all began as young musicians, Getty says. It's our duty to pass on our experiences. But as he said earlier, he treats this orchestra absolutely as an ensemble of professionals, ready to walk into professional careers tomorrow. Well, as you can hear, the audience here at the Royal Albert Hall don't want it to be over. A few people leaving, but not many. There is, of course, a great tradition of encores from visiting orchestras. And I think we might be about to get one. Getty on the rostrum. Waves at the audience, turns to face his orchestra. the prelude to the third act of Wagner's Master Singers of Nuremberg. And after a concert which began with the prelude to Act 3 of Parsifal, what a neat way to end it, especially after the energy of La Valse. Well, the orchestra now off to the Concertgebouw in Amsterdam and the Streza Festival on this, their silver jubilee season. Chance to see this prom on television, BBC 4 on Thursday night. Well, I'll be back tomorrow morning at 6:30 for breakfast here on Radio 3. Do join me then if you're up early. If you're having a restful bank holiday, do enjoy your day. But for now, as Daniele Gatti returns to the platform once again, and en masse the Gustav Mahler Youth Orchestra rise to their feet. Good night from the Royal Albert Hall. Back to Ian Skelly at Broadcasting House.
Petrarch, thank you very much. Petrarch Trelawney with tonight's prom. The entire hall swept up by all that swirling music by Ravel there. A whirlwind evoking such destruction and collapse. Marvellous stuff. Well, you can hear the whole of that concert again, including that final encore of Wagner, if you'd like to, on Friday the 7th of September. It forms afternoon on 3 that day. It's on the radio from 2 that afternoon. Or you can hear it when you'd like to, if you have access to the internet. It's available to listen to again for the next 7 days on the Radio 3 website. Tomorrow afternoon, incidentally, we're not going to be listening to a prom's repeat, but we'll be live at the Royal Albert Hall for a family prom, a matinee of music that takes you right round the world. The Northern Sinfonia will be your guides, playing music by Dvorak, Delius, Rodrigo and Bizet, amongst others. And they'll be joined by a variety of guest artists, amongst them the guitarist Miloš Karadaglić, for instance, and the gospel choir, the Blind Boys of Alabama. I should be there to introduce that concert. Louise Fryer will be your hostess on stage throughout. It should be fun, all from 3 o'clock tomorrow afternoon here on Radio 3. And one of the two principal guest conductors of the Northern Sinfonia will be in charge of the music in our evening prom tomorrow night, John Wilson. He makes another welcome return visit to this year's season with his John Wilson Orchestra. Tomorrow night, paying tribute to the Broadway stage. Plenty of music by Gershwin, Cole Porter, Rodgers, Adler and Ross, amongst others. As ever with John Wilson's concerts, it should be an uplifting, not to say stunning, evening. It all begins here on BBC Radio 3, live at 8 o'clock tomorrow night. Well, now, what of the rest of tonight on Radio 3? World Roots takes you to Sri Lanka in 15 minutes. Music from that part of the world and the sounds of the place and its customs, all from 10 o'clock tonight. Then we're going to turn our attention to jazz. Claire Martin will introduce this week's edition of Jazz Lineup and a concert given at Wavendon, the Dankworth Residence of Music venue. The Velocity Trio will be on stage from 11 tonight in Jazz Lineup. But with that music by Ravel still hopefully ringing in your ears, I thought we could have a bit more music by Ravel now for smaller forces and a piece reflecting Ravel's roots in the Basque region. He spent only the first 3 months of his life there, but in later years he did want to reflect where he came from in a typically evocative piece. And it's a region which is also the birthplace and homeland of the two pianists here, the sisters Katia and Marielle Labeck. Here they are playing a couple of movements from the two piano version of Ravel's Rhapsody Espagnole. Thank you. Music by Maurice Ravel, a two-piano version of his Rhapsody Espagnole, the opening prelude à la nuit and the final feria. They were played by the fellow Basques, Katia and Marielle Labeque.
On BBC Radio 3, a third week of concerts from the 2012 Edinburgh International Festival. Each weekday morning from 11, Monday to Friday, we have live performances from Edinburgh's Queen's Hall, featuring two hot piano properties, Francesco Piemontesi and Lear Williams. We have song recitals by the German baritone Dietrich Henschel and British tenor Toby Spence. And to finish the week, the energetic sound of the all-standing and outstanding Australian Chamber Orchestra. Weekday mornings from the 2012 Edinburgh Festival on Radio 3 from 11 o'clock.
A reflection on an ancient air, the first movement of a suite for orchestra by Respighi. It was played there by the Hungarian Philharmonic in a recording made in 1958 and conducted by Antal Dorati. This is BBC Radio 3. The time now is 10 o'clock. It's time for World Roots. And this week, Lucy Duran heads off on a journey around the island of Sri Lanka.
There's a tooth in here. Not any tooth, mind you. A tooth that's been symbolic of rule here in Sri Lanka for well over 2,000 years. It's none other than a tooth of the Buddha, whisked away from his funeral pyre in 483 BC and then brought to this island, Sri Lanka, some 800 years later, where it eventually ended up in Kandy, in this Buddhist temple, enshrined in seven caskets, no less. This morning, the caskets will be washed and crowds are gathering to receive the blessed water. Important part of the ceremony, which happens every Wednesday here at this temple in Kandy, and that is the water that the casket has been washed with, the casket that contains the tooth of Buddha. And there's a queue that stretches all the way around the shrine of people who are with arms outstretched with their little containers, plastic bottles, little medicine phials into which one man is pouring water. It looks kind of reddish water. So hands outstretched to receive this water that's washed the caskets. Clearly, this is an extremely important and sacred moment for Buddhists in Sri Lanka. Sri Lanka is a teardrop-shaped island that hangs off the bottom of the Indian subcontinent. The Arab traders called it Serendib, meaning full of surprises, from which we get our word serendipity. Sri Lanka's a diverse mix of peoples, cultures, and religions. Sinhala is the most widely spoken language, and for the Sinhalese, Kandy, where I am now, represents the historical seat of the Sinhalese kingdom, which resisted Portuguese and Dutch invasions and only finally succumbed to the British in 1815. Although the early settlers of this island were Sinhalese and Tamil from India, Sri Lanka's position on the Indian Ocean trade routes has resulted in a rich mix of cultures, languages, and music. We'll be traveling around the island to hear some of these unique musical traditions. But first, we're off to the Low Country to hear a virtuosic drumming tradition based on astrological rituals, played by a family of drummers who maintain an ancient style of singing. To balenga mau bidavata da samasa viruna roli pula ano hazinga dosa duru kala viva obata jaya manga pangliya vesa onga samadhi asalu yanata vadina kala rambili maya sema kumaru maugya batula
Do not be wrong, but So here we are on this rooftop, surrounded by coconut palms. We're about 12 kilometers south of Colombo, the capital. Yeah. And the person who's going to tell me all about this is an ethnomusicologist called Sumudi Surawira. So tell me about this family, family of drummers.
So we're exactly in a place called Panipitia. The family consists of a father and two siblings. Father is his name's Essen Daniel. He's quite a well-known astrologist and comes from a lineage of traditional drumming, dancing, and basically ritual work. And the two sons, Susanta Rupatilaka, who's on the left of me at the moment, he's very well-known, recognized dancer, drummer, and a musician. And the other brother, who's the younger brother, Prasanta Rupatilaka, he's a drummer and, I guess, choreographer, dance ensembles.
So I'm going to ask you about the astrology in a moment, but yes. Susanta, can you tell me what you were singing about in that song?
Pahatrata Shanti Karma Ola, Shanti Karma Avasana Edi, Aaturayata Sitpata.
So what you heard was an excerpt from a low country ritual. The performers, at the end of a ritual, bless the patient, and the verses basically describe virtues of the Buddha and the qualities of the Buddha.
So this music is the music of the majority people of this island, who are the Sinhala.
Yeah, Sinhala music, it mostly consists of singing and drumming, and it also has dance as a really close accompaniment. So low country drumming is one of three traditions, the other two being up country and Sabaragamu.
Three traditions of the Sinhala people.
Yeah, and the three different traditions have distinct drums, which make them unique within themselves. The low country has a double-sided drum called the Yakpere.
That's the one which is a long cylinder.
Yeah, and the up country drum is called the Gatabere. That's the one with the bulging waist. And the Sabaragamu has shorter cylindrical drum called the Daula.
Well, I was very intrigued, Sumudi, when you told me that the father of these two brothers, S.N. Daniel, is in fact an astrologer, because that's an interesting combination of professions, musician and astrologer.
Yeah. Actually, the whole ritual music is based around astrology. Perhaps if I give you a little bit of background on astrology, there's a thing called the horoscope. It's something that, I guess it is a Buddhist cultural belief in Sri Lanka, that if something goes wrong, one of the things that you might consult would be this horoscope. And belief is that there are nine planets, and each of the planets have deities associated with it. And each of these deities may have influence upon what you do. And if you're going through a rough time, it could be that some of these planetary movements are not favorable for you. So an astrologer's job is to consult this very complex horoscope, and someone like Essen Daniel would recommend a ritual or some way of minimizing these effects.
So the ritual, it's a healing ritual, yeah. Or it's yeah. making things better that have gone wrong.
Yeah.
So here we are on the rooftop of the family house. We're not at a ritual. How long would a ritual go on for? How long would they have to play?
Typically, a ritual would start around 7:38. 8 o'clock in the evening, and it might go on till about 5 o'clock or 6 o'clock in the morning.
So that means they're playing for 10 hours non-stop.
Yeah,
that's quite a long time.
Yeah, when they start at 8 o'clock, they would every hour or so they might have a 5-minute break, but they'd be going all night.
Well, unfortunately, we haven't got 10 hours to witness the whole ritual, but it would be wonderful to hear some part of the ritual, at least some excerpts of the Low Country ritual. That was fantastic and really unusual drumming and singing by this family who have clearly been passing down these traditions through generations, giving me a real sense of an ancient sound from this island, a sound that's been used to heal in all-night rituals for many centuries. We're now on the road, winding through the palm-covered hills in the center of this island. We're going through endless small towns, which are clogged with auto rickshaws, lorries, brightly painted. I've seen one wild elephant. I've seen a monitor lizard. That was exciting. I've seen many mangy dogs and loads of monkeys. We're heading east about 300 kilometers to the other side of Sri Lanka. We're going to a coastal town called Batticaloa, which is now recovering from the long years of civil war, also from the 2004 tsunami, and most recently from terrible flooding. It's a town that's made up of Tamils, of Sinhalese, and of Muslims. But we're going to meet a man called Sunny Okats.
The Burghers are the descendants of the Portuguese. Portuguese came to Sri Lanka in 1505, and eventually they came to Batticaloa also. And then some of the people who came there, they didn't want to go back. They stayed back in Batticaloa.
It's very beautiful. I don't blame them.
Yeah, yeah. So they eventually got expanded, and now we have about 2,000 families in the district.
Do you remain very much within your own community?
Oh yes, yes. And also, you know, this was formed as early as 1927.
Which, the union?
The union. At that time, you know, the elders formed a group, mainly to preserve the culture and the Catholic faith and the language of the Portuguese.
I'm with two distinguished senior members of the Burger community. This is Sunny Okats, who is the president of the Burger Union here in Batticaloa, and Rachel Margarita,
old school,
who is a singer. Sunny, it's incredible that you say that the Portuguese came here in 1505,
yeah,
and that you are descendants of those Portuguese. So your community has kept this alive, the Portuguese culture alive, for five centuries. Yes. That is really a remarkable story.
That's right. And also the language, you know, it's not written and people have not studied. It's from the word of mouth, you know, by speaking. Parents speak to the children, then children, their children, like that. It has come for five centuries.
But is it like Portuguese, the Portuguese that you would speak in Portugal today?
No. Mm-hmm. The thing is, the pronunciation is different. That's all. But then when you speak very slowly, they understand.
And the young kids in your community, are they also speaking Portuguese?
Certain families.
I see Rachel is shaking her head.
That's why I'm coming here. Now, as you said, from our infancy, some mothers, now we are with a mixed multitude. So most of them, they talk Tamil. That is the most important language here in Batticaloa. But the small children, I feel very sorry for them. In my family, my children, grandchildren, some two of them are married to Tamils. Even them, I talk to them in Portuguese because I want to keep up our culture. Now I see they are Muslims, Tamils, all are fighting for their own. Nobody for to fight us. So though I am old, I am giving these young children this thing, rousing, so that they can bring up and they can talk.
Why are you called Burghers?
Burger comes from a city. City citizen is called a Burgher. That's what it means.
Yeah.
How badly was your community affected by the tsunami of 2004?
Very badly, very badly. About nearly more than 200 lost their lives. You know, they were living along the seacoast. So when the water dashed in, most of the houses were just
destroyed.
It was in shambles.
A huge
loss to the community.
And yet you've managed to rebuild and you have your union
building
here.
Oh, yes.
Sunny, we're about to hear Burger music. This will be my first time ever hear and to see this music being played.
You'll really enjoy the music.
I've just heard a little bit of tuning up, and it says two violins.
After you are energized, automatically you want to get up and dance.
I'm sure I will.
You know, and also this music is in five parts, and each has a different music and different dance.
But when do you play this kind of music?
You know, when the bride and bridegroom enter the bride's house, There's a different music that is played.
And there's a different music when they cut the cake.
Cake also, there's a different music.
But this music,
yeah,
your music, it's mainly wedding music. Is yes. that yeah. right?
Kafrinya.
Dance.
Kafrinya.
Kafrinya dance, you know.
So it's the music is called Kafrinya.
Kafrinya. Yes. Music, not the music. The dance is called Kafrinya.
We can't say what the meaning, but that is the name. That is a proper noun.
No
meaning.
This music is preserved for centuries. Yes. This music is not played by anybody else. Some they copy may have copied now, but then this music is only in respect to the Portuguese in Baticlo.
So we're about to hear music that is totally unique.
Unique, that's
to right. this particular part of the east of Sri Lanka.
That's right.
And which has survived for five centuries.
Correct.
Amazing. Let's go and hear it.
Yeah, come.
But if we are more careful, it will be still continue for centuries and centuries, never ending.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
Because we don't want the burgers to end.
Yeah.
That was totally unexpected and utterly delightful. And you really had a sense that it's been going on for 500 years and it's the music of the Portuguese brought to Sri Lanka, being continued by these people, by this small community of people who call themselves Burghers here in Batticaloa in the east of the island. It's time for us to go now, and the musicians are playing us a farewell song, because there's one more thing that we must do while we're here in Batticaloa, and that's to hear the singing fish of Batticaloa Lagoon. Legend has it that in this lagoon are singing fish. The mind slightly boggles. We don't really know what on earth they are. But people say that if you head into the middle of the lagoon on a full moon night, like tonight, you'll hear something really extraordinary. And this fisherman reckons that he knows exactly where to find this very, very strange sound. So I am going to clamber into this very, very narrow canoe, which is balanced by a log that's attached to the side of it. It's a kind of outrigger thing. I'm thankful for it because apart from singing fish in the lagoon, there are apparently crocodiles, and I'm sure the crocodiles don't sing. Well, it's a really beautiful experience to be on this lagoon in this canoe with its outrigger. It's a wonderful, warm, balmy night under the moonlight, but alas, no sign of the singing fish. And lots of people have told us that since the conflict started in Sri Lanka, that the fish just stopped singing. So, conflict is over, but they're still not singing, at least not tonight.
Bastante palongi non è buscando e vi avrì bosse porte non è dentro pavì. Avrì bosse porte non è dentro pavì. Astante pelongi e buscando e vi.
The name Kafirinha, from kafir or unbeliever, came up as a dance in Batticaloa among the Burger community. We're now back on the west coast of Sri Lanka, where we're now with a group of people who were descended from slaves brought here from the east coast of Africa, and they proudly call themselves Kafir.
Minha rabana,
Well, this is the music of the Kafir Manja group, and it's like being on the east coast of Africa. I feel a little piece of Africa right here in Sri Lanka. It's amazing that you've kept this tradition alive. The instruments are these two barrel drums which you're playing with your hands. That's different from any other drumming that we've heard here in Sri Lanka, where drumming seems to be a really strong part of the musical scene. And then the lead singer is playing two coconut shells cut in half on a table. That's that kind of the driving beat. Plus there's this round frame drum, which is called Rabana. And there's a bottle, a nice big empty bottle being tapped on with two coins. And finally a pair of spoons and lots of singing, wonderful singing. And the leader of this group, of the Kafir Manja group, is Peter Louis. So Peter, first of all, tell me about the Kafirs. What do you know about your history?
The Kafir came to Sri Lanka in 1815, but our group came to Sri Lanka in 1817. From that, we are continue to live in Sri Lanka as the Sri Lankans.
Do you know where in Africa you come from originally?
We came from the Mozambique in South Africa.
Southern Africa.
We used the Portuguese as our language, and at that period, they brought us as soldiers to fight with the Sri Lankan kingdom. Portuguese ruled some part of the island, and at that period, there was Sinhala kings also. So there was a civil conflict in the country. So they brought from Mozambique as soldiers to fight with the Sri Lankan citizens.
Ah, so you were brought in order to fight against the Sinhalese kingdom.
Yeah.
Because now you're speaking in Sinhala, is that right?
Yes.
But when you're at home in your Sirambiadi, where you live, are you speaking in Portuguese with each other?
Our grandfathers used that language, but we have to go to the Sinhala school and we have to learn in Sinhala. So now we are using Sinhala as our language. But still we use that songs in the original language.
That means that you preserve a lot of your culture through the music.
Yes, we are continuing our tradition with the music.
Is there any form of racism towards you because you were of African origin?
Earlier we had a lot of problem, but now, no. Now we all live together.
Peter, from what you said, though, it would seem to me that your community is gradually integrating into the general Sri Lankan community and that you're losing some of your traditions, like your own language, the Portuguese-derived language. Is that the case?
There was no force to integrate with Sri Lankan society, but we had a problem because our community was so little and we had few men. So our ladies to marry with Sinhala people and they have to go to the, our children has to go to the Sinhala school. Because there was no Portuguese school here. It's the reason that we integrated with there, but still we could continue our tradition without losing it.
When the Arab traders called this island Serendib, meaning full of surprises, they were absolutely right because this music is indeed a complete surprise. I mean, who would have thought that we would have found a piece of East Africa here in Sri Lanka?
Akalimako Amira Vakume
Ayao Akalimako Amira Vakume
Amira Vakume Maku Amira Vakume
Amira Vakume Maku Amira Vakume
Ayao Akalimako Amira Vakume
Ayao Akalimako Amira Vakume
Amira
Vakume Makua
driving around Sri Lanka, the weather's gone from searing hot to torrential rain and tropical storms. The landscape from dry red dust to lush green hills and brown rivers. We've seen Muslims, Hindus, Buddhists, and Christians. And everywhere we've been, we've seen people playing cricket on beaches, on patches of waste ground, even alongside busy roads like this one in Colombo. It's obvious that cricket is much more than just a national sport. It's almost like a religion. It's a sense of Sri Lankan identity. And this year, the Sri Lankan national team made it to the finals of the Cricket World Cup, but they were narrowly beaten by their closest neighbor, India. The soundtrack to that tournament, the soundtrack to cricket here in Sri Lanka, is a uniquely Sri Lankan musical force, and that's what we've come to hear now, the Papare Band.
Thank you.
Well, I confess to knowing very little about cricket. Actually, I know nothing about cricket, but I've been told that this music gets the crowd on their feet in a big way at a cricket match here in Sri Lanka, and I'm really not surprised because it's a fantastic sound. And it's strange because there are moments when it sounds like a mariachi band from Mexico, or it even sounds like Balkan gypsy music. It's really remarkable, but no, it's the music of Sri Lanka. It's what's known as a papare band. There are two trumpets, there's a cymbal, there are cymbals, there's two side drums, and then there's a double-headed drum called the tavil. And this is one of Sri Lanka's best-known papare bands. They're called the Kuja Papara Band. This is a leader, Kuja, who the band is named after. Well, tell us about papara.
Papara band is a match.
The papara band is played for cricket match, temple festivals, perahara, which is a procession at the Buddhist temple, wedding parties and parties. Although papara band is played for other events, this is mostly and commonly placed during the cricket match in Sri Lanka. And cricket means fun, papara means fun.
But I was told that at one point in this recent Cricket World Cup that papara music was banned. Is that true?
அது உண்மையா நடந்துச்சு. அப்படி இருந்தாலும் நாங்க வந்து ஹோட்டல் லைன்ல வந்து பெரிய ஸ்கிரீன் போட்டு அதுல வாசிச்சோம்.
Very true. We were not allowed to play our band at the cricket pitch. So we started playing at the hotels where the cricket teams were staying, where people gathered to watch the cricket on big screen. But later on, people started complaining, saying that if you are going to ban papare and not then allowing them to play in the cricket pavilions, we are not going to watch the cricket. Therefore, police, in order to allow them, and then the government said, okay, you can play. So they started playing at the stadiums in
Colombo.
I noticed that all the neighbors around here have come along. There's even some people on this balcony across the way from this little garden here. Everyone is dancing. You're like the Pied Piper of Sri Lanka. As soon as they hear your music, they'll follow you and dance.
If we get hired during the election campaign by a politician, people will not come out to see the particular politician, but they will definitely come out to see us and then stand dance with us on the street.
What do you know about the history of papare music?
Papare nu solitta yaarume koopu adu enna nu sonna inda rampat ku dhaan vandu inda rampat papara papapa papara papapa.
He says, I got involved with papare from 1983 onwards. He says that the noise made on trumpet,
which goes
connects to the name papara.
So it's just the sound of the trumpet.
Papare rumpet. Papara papa 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 papara papa. How? Papare.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. It's been really great hearing this music. And let's end with one more piece of music because I personally am ready to get up and dance.
That was the Kuja Papara band, recorded especially for World Roots on location in Colombo in Sri Lanka last year. The presenter of World Roots was Lucy Duran and the producer was Peter Meanwell. Well, we turn our attention to jazz in just a moment after a look ahead to some special concerts later this week here on Radio 3.